Iranians take to the streets across the country condemning the desecration of sanctities and acts of vandalism during recent riots. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi blasts the West for applying double standards regarding such topics as terrorism, human rights, and nuclear issues. And Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has called on the international community to hold apartheid Israeli regime accountable for its heinous crimes. Hello, everybody, and a very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, Iranians have taken to the streets across the country denouncing the recent riots in a number of cities. Protests were held following Friday prayers. Demonstrators slammed the desecration of Iranian sanctities as well as acts of vandalism during the riots. Rioters blocked streets and vandalized public property, including police vehicles and ambulances. Riots were triggered by the death of 22-year-old woman Mahsa Amini days after she collapsed at a police station. Police have released CCTV footage of the incident. Tehran Police Commander Hossein Rahimi has rejected claims of physical violence against her. Officials say a probe is underway into her death. We spoke to political commentator Sam Mahdi Torabi about the recent riots in Iran.
The problem in Iran is that whenever these things happen, we end up with rioting, because the goal of the Americans is to cause destabilization in Iran. So this is, I think, a big problem. The second issue, which I think is very important that we need to understand, is that the reality that is on the ground in Iran, in terms of understanding Iranian society, is very different than the thing that virtual reality that exists online. The reality is that in Iran, as we saw today with the rallies and the demonstrations that were going on, is that the vast majority of people in Iran are religious. They adhere to religious laws, to the laws of Islam, and they want the country to be governed according to Islam. The fact that they are not all on Twitter or on Instagram doesn't mean that that's not the reality of the society.
President Ebrahim Raisi is back in Iran after his visit to New York to attend and address the UN General Assembly. Upon arrival, Raisi blasted West's double standards, saying such hypocrisy has caused serious problems around the world.
The UN General Assembly was a chance for us to elaborate on the stance of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We called for refraining from unilateralism and from exercising double standards regarding terrorism, human rights, and the nuclear issue. We objected to the double standard approach that exists in the West regarding global issues, whose resolution requires firm positions. This double standard policy causes serious problems worldwide.
Raisi also called for the removal of cruel U.S. sanctions against Iran. He also said the UN must remain unbiased and represent all nations, not just big powers. He added that enemies failed to silence the voice of Iran during his visit to New York. Raisi said that during his bilateral meetings on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, numerous countries around the world voiced eagerness to forge closer ties with Tehran.
World leaders have gathered in New York to attend the UN General Assembly. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi was among the leaders to have attended the international event.
During a speech, President Raisi hailed Iran's, quote, prominent and progressive role in confronting high-handed and interventionist policies, especially terrorism that is instigated and supported by the U.S. Raisi noted that thanks to General Soleimani's commandership, Iran emerged to thwart the plots that were aimed at manipulating the geopolitics of the West Asia region.
The fair pursuit of justice in the face of the crime the former American president admitted to is serving the humanity. We will seek through a fair tribunal to bring to justice those who ordered and those who committed the martyrdom of our beloved General Qasem Soleimani.
Raisi also said that Iran will follow up the prosecution of the former American president Donald Trump through a just court. The assassination of General Soleimani was directly ordered by Trump and occurred near Baghdad Airport on January 3, 2020. Raisi also held the emergence of a new world order that's in the making. The crisis has reshaped the geopolitics of not only Europe, but also the West and East Asia regions. The Ukraine war and the crises that followed have created new alliances and enmities. The U.S.-led bloc is locked in an all-out confrontation with Russia. And in order to avoid Western pressure, Russia has launched its policy to look for allies in the East. Moscow is now getting closer to Beijing and Tehran. And new alliances like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS grouping of countries are getting more powerful.
Holding up a picture of General Qasem Soleimani, President Ebrahim Raisi also said Tehran wants justice for his assassination ordered by former U.S. President Donald Trump. He also spoke about the emergence of a new world order, saying that U.S. hegemony is coming to an end.
The emerging new world order is giving more weight to multilateralism as the key to overcome the ongoing challenges. The unilateralism of the U.S. is seen as the key obstacle to a more just world order. The fate of many countries, especially countries in the West Asia region, shows that the U.S. is pursuing its own interests against the interests of its allies. Iran is among the countries that has pursued an independent policy since its inception.
Some may have the perception that our ties with Eastern countries such as Russia and China, saying that there are more closer ties with those countries, that is, prior to this administration, there was the perception that the government just focused on merely a number of countries in the West. But if I want to speak about my administration's perspective, it's a balanced one, having a view towards all countries. Any country that wants to cooperate with the Islamic Republic of Iran, we have our policy of interaction and cooperation with all countries, with priority given to neighboring states.
And that has drawn anger and frustration on the part of the U.S. and its Western and regional countries. During the U.N. General Assembly, U.S. President Joe Biden criticized Russia for its war on Ukraine.
Russia has shamelessly violated the core tenets of the United Nations Charter. No more important than the clear prohibition against countries taking the territory of their neighbor by force.
But it's high time to remind Washington regime of its long history of wars and interventions all over the world, especially the West Asia region.
And in terms of the veto, the U.S. president said that veto-wielding members should refrain from excessive use of their veto power. This is while the U.S. has deployed its veto power dozens of times to protect Israel.
The U.S. must also be held accountable for its use of double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights.
Iran has underlined its strong opposition to any changes in the region's borders and geopolitical landscape amid tensions in the South Caucasus. The Iranian foreign minister said that the Islamic Republic is ready to help Azerbaijan and Armenia peacefully resolve their differences. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a meeting with the Azerbaijani foreign minister, Jehun Bayramov, in New York. Bayramov said his country seeks a swift resolution to the border and territorial disputes with Armenia through regional cooperation. The situation on the border between the two sides remains tense after a ceasefire ended 2 days of clashes that killed nearly 200 troops last week. Fighting is linked to decades-old hostilities over control of the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has reiterated the apartheid nature of the Israeli regime, urging the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes. In a speech at the UN General Assembly, Abbas said Israel has committed heinous crimes against Palestinians since its establishment in 1948. He added the regime has carried out over 50 that has massacred since then, including its 2021 aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip, which left dozens of innocent children dead. Abbas also criticized the UN for Israel's persistent violations of international law, noting that none of the resolutions adopted by its various organs have been implemented. He stressed that Israel kills Palestinians with impunity and challenged the U.S., Israel's main ally, to prosecute the Israeli killers of veteran journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The Palestinian president also vowed to take legal action against Israel at the International Criminal Court and other world tribunals. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have rallied to express solidarity with Al-Quds. A rally follows recent provocations by Israeli settlers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon reports.
Palestinians rallied in Gaza following the Friday prayer to condemn Israeli violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. Protesters condemned the Israeli provocative measures, vowing to protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa. In recent days, Israeli regime forces have increased their presence near Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, taking advantage of Jewish holidays. Dozens of Jewish settlers were also allowed to storm the holy shrine and perform religious rituals. Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque, emphasizing that any provocative move against the sacred site will only infuriate Palestinians.
The Zionist criminal enemy is playing with fire and gunpowder that will only explode in its face. The enemy must not forget the sword of Al-Quds battle. If the Zionists continue to desecrate Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, we will wage bigger battles against them.
Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes who normalized ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against Al-Quds.
Those Arab and Islamic countries who normalize their ties with the Zionist enemy are encouraging it to violate and desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. Those countries have lost their moral compass and must correct their mistakes before it's too late.
Protesters slammed British Prime Minister Liz Truss for promising Israeli regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid to consider relocating the British embassy to Al-Quds. Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the eternal capital of Palestine.
We came here today to support Al-Aqsa and to say to the whole world that Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line. We also want to condemn the British Prime Minister's statements about relocating the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds.
Palestinians have also condemned the international community's silence on Israeli crimes in Al-Quds.
Analysts say the Israeli regime and its regional and international backers are responsible for the escalation of violence in Al-Quds and Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Washington has warned Moscow over the polls it is holding in four Ukrainian regions on joining Russia.
We are prepared to impose additional swift and severe economic costs on Russia, along with our allies and partners, in response to these actions if they move forward with annexation. With our partners around the world in rejecting...
Official added U.S. and its allies reject outcome of the referenda, which she said will be fabricated. Votes are being held in Donetsk and Luhansk in the east, as well as Kherson and Zaporizhia in the south. Polls will close Tuesday. Western leaders have strongly criticized the ballots as preparations for Russia annexing the four regions. Ukraine has rejected them as well, calling the votes a farce. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has condemned the accusations as an attempt to spread Russophobia. Global stock markets tumble after several central banks raise interest rates to bring soaring inflation under control as recession fears grow. Wall Street's three major indices all recorded losses for a fourth consecutive day on Friday. They fell up to 1.8%, and it came after the Federal Reserve announced yet another hike in interest rates. European central banks, including the UK, have followed suit. Markets in the Eurozone were also over 2% in the red on Friday. That was amid drops in Asian markets for a third consecutive day. The British government has unveiled new plans to stimulate economic growth and ease the cost of living crisis. Now, the package includes tax cuts and billions of dollars worth of spending, but not everyone is convinced it's going to work. Saeed Puruza tells us why.
The pressure from the cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs, due in part to the war in Ukraine, is pushing more and more Britons into poverty. among them people with jobs. Across the nation, business after business has also closed up shop. More could follow. The government's answer, unleashing tens of billions of dollars to protect businesses from rising energy costs. But for many, such measures don't go far enough.
People are still suffering quite big energy and inflation, you know, and real wage cuts. But not if you're at the top end. You're actually going to be delighted with your extra 5% tax cut on your million-pound salary. I mean, it is ludicrous.
A global shortage of essentials from fuel to flour have seemingly made everything more expensive. Inflation in the UK stands at just under 10%, the highest in 40 years and highest across all G7 countries. In response, the Bank of England has raised interest rates, the cost of borrowing, to their highest in more than a decade to try and slow down people's spending and bring down prices.
The government is moving in a different direction, slashing taxes to get people to spend more. Good news for businesses on, for example, high street, but bad news for inflation.
Now, Mr. Speaker, this brings me to the cap on bankers' bonuses.
New Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng has announced cuts to taxes on richest individuals and the biggest companies, along with lifting the cap on bankers' bonuses. He and his prime minister's theory is that if the rich are allowed to get richer, instead of shouldering more of the nation's tax burden, everyone will benefit. And it has a name, trickle-down economics. Very few economists think it's a good idea.
I don't think this is going to be received well by the British public. What we want is an improved health service, dealing with social care, and this is not the time to be cutting tax on the wealthy like this. It is, as I say, astonishingly inept.
In the past 10 years of Conservative government, the UK has experienced stagnated productivity, investment and wages. Many are questioning whether this government can really turn the tide on years of economic decline. Sai Puriza, London.
Thanks for tuning in, and do stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The vast consequences of Hurricane Fiona shows that Puerto Rico is still hampered by U.S. colonial control. People are showing resilience in the face of Hurricane Fiona in Puerto Rico, where the power grid crashed across the entire island due to the storm. Many who learned from 2017's Hurricane Maria are dipping into their personal water reserves and using power generators. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the first part. According to Associated Press, Hurricane Fiona struck Puerto Rico's southwest coast recently as it unleashed landslides, knocked the power grid out, and ripped up asphalt from roads and flung the pieces around. Hundreds of people were evacuated or rescued across the island as floodwaters rose swiftly. Rushing rivers of brown water enveloped cars, first floors, and even an airport runway in the island's southern region. Forecasters said the storm threatened to dump historic levels of rain, with up to 30 inches, 76 centimeters, possible in eastern and southern Puerto Rico. Governor Pedro Pierluisi said the damages that we are seeing are catastrophic. The storm washed away a bridge in the central mountain town of Utuado that police say was installed by the National Guard after Hurricane Maria hit in 2017. Large landslides also were reported, with water rushing down big slabs of broken asphalt and into gullies. Fiona was centered 45 miles, about 75 kilometers south to southeast of Punta Cana, Dominican Republic, with maximum sustained winds of 85 meters per hour, according to the U.S. National Hurricane Center. It was moving to the west-northwest at 10 meters per hour. Fiona struck on the anniversary of Hurricane Hugo, which hit Puerto Rico 33 years ago as a Category 3 storm. The storm's clouds covered the entire island, and tropical storm force winds extended as far as 140 miles, 220 kilometers from Fiona Center. Joe Biden declared a state of emergency in U.S. territory as the eyes of the storm approached the island's southwest corner. LUMA, the company that operates power transmission and distribution, said bad weather, including winds of 80 meters per hour, had disrupted transmission lines, leading to a blackout on all the island. Current weather conditions are extremely dangerous and are hindering the capacity to evaluate the complete situation, it said, adding that it could take several days to fully restore power. Health centers were running on generators, and some of those had failed. Health Secretary Carlos Mellado said crews rushed to repair generators at the comprehensive center where several patients had to be evacuated. Fiona hit just 2 days before the anniversary of Hurricane Maria, a devastating Category 4 storm that struck on September 20, 2017, destroying the island's power grid and causing nearly 3,000 deaths. More than 3,000 homes still have only a blue tarp as a roof, and infrastructure remains very weak, including the power grid. Outages remain common, and reconstruction started only recently. And CBC reported Hurricane Fiona roared over the Dominican Republic a day after knocking out power to all of Puerto Rico and causing damage the governor described as catastrophic. Many people were also left without water service. The blow from Fiona was made more devastating because Puerto Rico has yet to recover from Hurricane Maria, which killed nearly 3,000 people and destroyed the power grid in 2017. 5 years later, more than 3,000 homes on the island still have blue tarps for roofs. The wind and water from Fiona stripped the pavement from roads, tore off roofs, and sent torrents pouring into homes. The storm also took out a bridge and flooded two airports. Authorities reported 2 deaths from the hurricane, a Puerto Rican man who was swept away by a flooded river, and a person in the Dominican Republic who was hit by a falling tree. The storm was still expected to dump up to 38 centimeters of rain in some places as it spun away from the U.S. territory that is home to 3.2 million people. Forecasts call for the storm to grow into a major hurricane of Category 3 or greater and said it was on a path expected to pass close to Turks and Seychelles Islands and was not likely to threaten the U.S. mainland. According to CBC, one death was also associated with a blackout in Puerto Rico. A 70-year-old man who was burned to death after he tried to fill his generator with gasoline while it was running, officials said. Governor Pedro Pierluisi declined to say how long it would take to fully restore electricity, but he said for most customers in Puerto Rico, it would be a question of days. Fiona previously battered the Eastern Caribbean, killing one man in the French territory of Guadeloupe when floodwaters washed his home away, officials said. The system hit Puerto Rico on the anniversary of Hurricane Hugo, which slammed into the island in 1989 as a Category 3 storm.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Back to Reality, and thank you for joining us. So, I am Asma, your humble host. I am a student of English literature. And in here, I have with me two very dear guests, Zainab and Bita. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's a really big pleasure for me to join you for this discussion. I am Bita, a medical student from Iran.
And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm Zainab Sadat. I'm from Iran and I have my MA in TFL, teaching English as a foreign language. And it's my pleasure to be here today in this discussion.
Thank you very much, both of you. Thank you for joining us in today's episode. So, dear listeners, previously we talked about the need of having a religion and the need of applying all the rules of religion into our life, into different dimensions of our life. We talked about the fact that people in the past used to have a very primitive understanding of their religion. And as everything grows and development happens in different aspects of science and social, economical issues, people start to grow even in their understanding of religion. And what happens is that sometimes maybe they might have some kind of thought that is going to be exactly the opposite of what we right now think, what we right now around this table think about religion. Many people might think that religion is depressing. Religion is going to make us feel like dull and it's not going to make us enjoy life in a
it simple... It confines you,
exactly.
In fact.
It's just like an imprisonment. To put it very much precise, I would say it looks like imprisonment to some people. Now, what's your idea upon this fact that religion is not going to depress you? Religion is not going to make you feel like you're not enjoying your life.
You know, first I'm going to start with the root of why people feel this depression, you know, upon themselves for religion. The thing is, most of the people just forget the presence of God, and this ignorance make them feel like, okay, this is a guideline that will rule me in this life, and I cannot choose what to do. Mm-hmm. I'm not the one who is choosing. This is religion that will lead me. And this feeling of, you know, being limited makes them feel depressed.
Exactly, Vita. Feeling limited.
Exactly.
That's the point.
But the thing is, you have to try to understand that religion is not limitation.
And how would you say that?
Even religion has two parts, materialistic parts and spiritual parts. And when you are just ignoring the spiritual part and the bond with God, you will, you know, face this depression. For, you know, just avoiding this situation, you have to strengthen your bond with God. And I think this is the only solution that will answer these problems for all the people around the world. Because there is a deep need in ourselves to just have someone always when you are alone, when you feel sad, when you are depressed, to rely on.
Yeah.
And who is better than God? And, you know, even in our religion, we have it as, you know, like something like taqwa, even tawakkul, and something
which
like
that. Which is self-control.
Exactly. And these are the things that will help you to overcome the feeling of depression in this road.
Yeah.
I don't say that being a religious person, being someone who is, you know, who have a strong belief in religion is something really easy. No, at all. It is difficult at the same time that it is, you know, somehow sweet, but at the same time difficult.
Yeah, it will inspire you, but at the very same time, it's going to be a very difficult journey.
Exactly. So first of all, you have to understand and accept this point.
Yeah.
That is difficult to be human.
So you just said that, according to what you said, limitation is the thing that makes people scared of religion, that makes them feel that, because, you know, in many groups and gatherings, I've seen it that when they see you, as it is very much clear from your appearance, if you are following a special rules or if you are considering your religion in different aspects of your life, it might be very much clear from your appearance. People would tell you like, okay, now that you are going by your religion and all the rules are just applied into your life, you are the one who is not going to enjoy life. I'm not going to be like you because religion is actually the thing that is not, you know what I mean? I mean, it's not going to help you enjoy life more and more. Some kind of a superficial point of view of discerning religion as something that brings you limitations. But you know, you agree with me that many people, when they see lots you of are people religious, have this, that idea, unfortunately. But as I said, it's a superficial point of view, I guess. Because, for example, I'm using this example that about fasting. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala asks us to stop eating for one day, you know, our nature as human beings is, it makes us eat and we enjoy eating. That's
So we naturally enjoy eating.
That's something that cannot be denied.
Yeah.
But we might find it difficult, bothering, and we might not feel okay with not eating.
As we are all the time, as comfortable as we are.
But when you go in depth, when you go into the philosophy of fasting, you find lots of things. As I said,
happiness
fasting,
and bliss.
Yes, fasting is just one simple example. You will feel...
when you even do your praying.
You will empathy with the poor. You will just try how to be more patient.
Yeah, and since we are just in the time that many people are going for the Arbaeen pilgrimage, then I would say that even that is very much difficult.
Yes, and that's
there
a lesson.
Plenty much of difficulties in the way, but still many people would go for it, and they're not depressed.
And they
throughout
learn
the way
lots of things from Arbaeen Messiah. Yes, they learn lots of things. So the superficial view is doing something difficult. Why should we go, for example, as you said, Messiah? Why should we go in a way in that hit? In that difficult situation.
For a person who does not believe in what the people who are going for this pilgrimage...
It might even seem silly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I said, in depth, there are lots of lessons and lots of positive points.
And love, of course, you know. Religion, I personally believe that religion is based on love.
Mm-hmm. Even when you are applying the rules of Allah into your life, it means that you are just showing your love to Allah.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
it is a manifestation of your love. When you love someone, you have to do something for them. You have mm-hmm. to show it in order to gain that love from that person.
And you know, all the human beings, with no exception, do lots of things and they go through lots of difficult situations for different things.
Yeah, yeah.
But they do not admit that. And when it comes to religion, it becomes something irrational.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that we are all doing difficult things because of our mothers, our beloved ones, our children, our friends, and lots of the group of people. But the religious people do all these difficulties for the sake of Allah.
Mm-hmm.
And in its nature, it's somehow the same. And that's
exactly,
in fact, my idea about this.
Yeah. Thank you, Zainab. And now let's go for a short break before I ask Bida's idea upon this thing that we're talking about. And then we'll be back. Thank you, dear listeners.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Well, dear listeners, welcome back. We are here in Back to Reality. We are discussing religion and how we must to apply that in different aspects of our life. We talked about the very fact that religion is not depressing. And we said that religion is supposed to make you happy, because when you are applying the rules of Allah into your life, you must feel that satisfaction of a person who is loving another person. So now, Bita, I have seen many people, for example, when they see a little girl, since you know that girls have to apply to rules at a very younger age.
Yeah.
And when many people see them, that they are going through fasting or, for example, praying or, for example, wearing hijab, they would accuse their parent for, why do you do this to your children? Oh, they are so poor little girl. And why are you going to draw them into this thing? Why do you drag them into this thing? Have you ever seen such incidents?
Exactly. I've seen this scenario and this scene.
This debate and negotiation.
More than what you think. More than what you think. Even about my sister, because my sister is 10 years old.
So she's new to the club.
Exactly. And, you know, always there are someone who's telling us, oh, come on, why are you making a job at this age? It's not that much necessary. You know, we're not talking about the necessity right now. The thing is, these kind of people that accuse other people for doing the right thing at the right age are the one who see a kind of position between life and joy and joy, life and religion. Mm-hmm. They think like, if you are a religious person, you won't enjoy anything.
Uh-huh, so you mean that they feel there is a separation between religion and your personal life. So if you're religious, you're not going to enjoy mm-hmm. life. That's exactly the same thing as I told you.
The thing is, as my dear sister Zainab told us, you know, there are some people who just see the beauty of religion. Mm-hmm. But you cannot just convince all of the people around the world that religion is something that should be in your life.
Exactly.
You cannot just force someone to do something.
Yeah.
But when you see someone that is willing to, acting as the guidelines of, for example, his or her own religion, you cannot just accuse her or him. You know, I'm really against that, bad behavior, really. When I see people, as you told me, that tells other people, why are you doing, this? We are, for example, here in a foreign country where we're making hijab, you don't consider the point that we are seeing God everywhere.
Exactly.
God is everywhere. No matter where you are, no matter you're in Iran, you're in an Islamic country or in a European country, you are Muslim, you have your own beliefs. And this is about the God, the presence of God.
Exactly.
Nothing else.
Yeah.
And also the thing is, this is about the passion you have for mm-hmm. God. And at the end, I want to tell you as a gist of our speaking.
Exactly.
You have to strengthen your bond with God. This is the only solution. This is the only answer. And this
yeah.
is the only way.
Mm-hmm. We see that in the narrations and also in the words of many scholars, we see that they talk about melting in the name of Allah. So if you come to that point in which you consider Allah in different step of your life, then it's not going to be something very much difficult. Then you would do it with love and satisfaction. It's not going to be a drudgery. It's no longer going to look like imprisonment, entanglement. Mm-hmm. It's going to be pretty much easier. I know that it might have some very much difficult appearance, because when people see you that you're wearing hijab, that seems naturally difficult. But when you do it for a greater cause, for a bigger goal, then it would sound pretty much easier to you as a person who is practicing the rules of Allah. So in today's episode, we were talking about religion. We talked about the controversial debate that many people believe religion is going to add limits into your life. You are going to be limited and you're not going to enjoy your life. But the truth is that it depends on the way you look at your religion. It depends on the bond you have created with your Lord. It depends on your spiritual journey, how much you work on it, how much you would love to grow throughout this journey. So as we talked, I guess we made it pretty much clear that religion is not imprisonment. Religion is not limitation. On the contrary, it's a way that is going to help you spread and grow bigger and bigger, because we have seen it as example of whatever that we're saying right now are the greater scholars that we have in our religion. We have greater scholars that they have accomplished so much, and at the same time, they were true obedient of Allah. So, dear listeners, thank you for staying with us. Until another time, I bid you farewell.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
IRIB English Radio Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Government documents that President Donald J. Trump had accumulated were with him in roughly 24 boxes in the White House residence. They were to go to the National Archives, but at least some of the top secret and confidential documents ended up in Mar-a-Lago in Florida. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman, Katie Banner, and Glenn Thrush. The piece is titled, the final days of the Trump White House. Chaos and scattered papers. Four days before the end of the Trump presidency, a White House aide peered into the Oval Office and was startled, if not exactly surprised, to see all of the president's personal photos still arrayed behind the Resolute desk, as if nothing had changed, guaranteeing the final hours would be a frantic dash mirroring the prior 4 years. In the area known as the Outer Oval Office, boxes have been brought in to pack up desks used by President Donald J. Trump's assistant and personal aides. But documents were strewn about, and the boxes stood nearly empty. The table in Donald Trump's private dining room off the Oval Office was stacked high with papers until the end, as it had been for its entire term. Upstairs in the White House residence, there were, however, a few signs that Donald Trump had finally realized his time was up. Papers he had accumulated in his last several months in office had been dropped into boxes, roughly 24 of them, and not sent to the National Archives. Aides had even retrieved letters from Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, and given them to Donald Trump in the final weeks, according to notes described to the New York Times. Where all of that material ended up is not clear. But what is plain, though, is that Mr. Trump's haphazard handling of government documents, a chronic problem, contributed to the chaos he created after he refused to accept his loss in the November 2020 presidential election, unleashed a mob on Congress, and set the stage for his second impeachment. His unwillingness to let go of power, including refusing to return government documents collected while he was in office, has led to a potentially damaging and entirely avoidable legal battle that threatens to engulf the former president and some of his aides. Although the White House counsel's office had told Mark Meadows, Mr. Trump's last chief of staff, that the roughly 24 boxes worth of material in the residence needed to be turned over to the National Archives. At least some of those boxes, including those with the Kim letters and some documents marked highly classified, were shipped to Florida. There, they were stored at various points over the past 19 months in different locations inside Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's members-only club, home and office, according to several people briefed on the events. Those actions, along with Donald Trump's protracted refusal to return the documents in Florida to the National Archives, prompted the Justice Department to review the matter early this year. This month, prosecutors obtained a warrant to search Mar-a-Lago for remaining materials, including some related to sensitive national security matters. The investigation is active and expanding, according to recent court filings, as prosecutors look into potentially serious violations of the Espionage Act and obstruction of justice. Many questions about the mishandling of the documents led to Donald Trump, who often treated the presidency as a private business. But people in his orbit also highlight the role of Mark Meadows, who oversaw what there was of a presidential transition. Mark Meadows assured aides that the hurried packing up of the White House would follow requirements about the preservation of documents, and he said he would make efforts to ensure that the administration complied with the Presidential Records Act, according to people familiar with those conversations. But as the clock ticked down, Donald Trump focused on pushing through last-minute pardons and largely ignored the transition he had tried to forestall. A spokesman for Donald Trump did not respond to a request for comment. Mr. Trump himself has denounced the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago as a witch hunt. His office has said he had a standing order that materials removed from the Oval Office and taken to the White House residence were deemed to be declassified the moment he removed them, although none of the three potential crimes cited in the FBI search warrant depend on whether removed documents are classified. A lawyer for Mark Meadows has declined to comment. In his final speech as president, Donald Trump declared, "We were not a regular administration." His statement was indisputably accurate. From his first hours in office, Donald Trump had always taken a proprietary view of the presidency, describing government documents and other property, even his staff, as his own personal possessions. "They're mine," is how he often put it, according to former aides. But that was not the case. Under the Presidential Records Act, the law that strictly governs the handling of records generated in the Oval Office, every document belongs to taxpayers. Whether the materials were national security briefings, reams of unclassified documents automatically uploaded to a secure server in Pennsylvania, or notes that Donald Trump routinely ripped up or flushed down the toilet, all were government property to be assessed and, in most cases, transferred as part of the nation's history to the National Archives. Donald Trump's lawyers and aides were well-versed in the Records Act, even if Donald Trump routinely flouted it. Donald F. McGahn, Mr. Trump's first White House counsel, instituted a protocol for the proper handling of materials and gave presentations under law to staff members, former officials, according to former officials. After the 2020 presidential election, White House officials held conversations about the fact that someone needed to retrieve documents that Mr. Trump had accumulated in the residence over many months, according to former officials. By the end of the Trump administration, the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and his deputy, Patrick Philbin, were keenly aware that Mr. Trump's handling of documents was a potential problem, according to people in their orbit. But it is unclear how much bandwidth either man had to deal with the issue. Donald Trump was on contentious terms with Mr. Cipollone after the election and often berated the lawyer for objecting to his attempts to subvert Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory, according to former officials. Adding to the disarray was the absence of the White House Staff Secretary Derek Lyons, who managed paperwork inside the executive complex but had stepped down on 18th of December 2020. That left Mark Meadows, a former House member with no significant executive experience before joining Donald Trump's staff, responsible for overseeing a transition process the president wanted no part of. Mark Meadows' immediate predecessors in that role, President Barack Obama's last chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, and President George W. Bush's final chief of staff, Joshua Bolton, had created teams to scrub West Wing offices of anything that belonged to the National Archives and made the stewardship of government records a priority. But it is unclear whether Mark Meadows took the same measures, according to former aides. But in the administration's final weeks, the White House emailed all of its offices detailed instructions about returning documents and cleaning out their spaces. Mark Meadows followed up on those notes and encouraged officers to comply, according to a person familiar with those conversations. Mark Meadows also assured White House staff members that he would talk to Donald Trump about securing records, including ones stashed in the residence, according to two people with knowledge of the situation. Regardless of whether Mark Meadows followed through on those promises, by early 2021, after Donald Trump had left the White House, Officials with the archives realized they were missing significant material. They reached out to, among others, Scott Garst, who had been a lawyer in the White House counsel's office under Donald Trump, and to Mr. Philbin. The two men, along with Mark Meadows and four other Trump officials, had been appointed by Donald Trump on his last full day in office to work with the National Archives. The archivists were particularly insistent about getting back the missing correspondence from the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and a letter left on the Resolute desk for Donald Trump by Barack Obama, both of significant historical value. Archives officials also asked Mr. Garst and Mr. Philbin about the roughly 24 boxes that had been in their residence during the Trump administration's final days. Mr. Philbin responded that he would work to get them in the hands of the National Archives and reached out to Mark Meadows, who said he would help make it happen, according to former officials. But archives officials did not get what they wanted until they traveled to Mar-a-Lago and retrieved 15 boxes of materials in January of 2022. Subsequently, archives officials told Donald Trump's team that they had identified social media records that had not been preserved, and that they had learned White House staff members had not preserved official business they had conducted on their personal electronic messaging accounts. They referred the matter to the Justice Department. In the spring, both Mr. Philbin and Mr. Garst were questioned by the FBI about the documents and the boxes. Pat Cipollone was also interviewed at some point. A grand jury was formed. In June, one of Donald Trump's lawyers signed a statement asserting that all relevant documents with classified markings from the boxes that had been requested, by then they were stored in a basement area at Mar-a-Lago, had been returned. The Justice Department would later file a detailed affidavit to a federal judge in Florida, revealing that the department believed possible crimes had been committed, precipitating the search of Mar-a-Lago on Monday, 8th of August.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.